Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is August 5th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm A. Martinez. It's Friday, 80 degrees and sunny. You got KPCC on the dial. Go ahead, soak in those SoCal vibes. That's why we're here. All right, coming up, we'll take a look at how solar power is being stored in, get this, salt. That's right, solar power in salt. That's coming up in about half an hour. But let's kick off this sunny Friday with some state of affairs. It's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. This week, California lawmakers denounce guns and white nationalism after a weekend of deadly shootings. We'll get into that and more with Rafe Sonnenschein. He directs the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Hello, Rafe.
Hey, A.
Also with us, Marisa Lagos, politics reporter for KQED. Welcome to you, Marisa. You there, Marisa?
Hey,
there you are. There you are. We thought you were soaking in the sunny Southern California vibe, so we thought maybe you were out of commission for a second.
I wish I was. I think we just had a momentary technical issue, but happy to be back with you guys. It's been a while.
All right, cool. There has been a flurry of responses from California lawmakers after two weekends of tragic shootings. Marisa, what has stood out to you so far?
I mean, unfortunately, sort of the routineness of all of this. You know, I think that we live in a state with very strong gun laws, and there's a lot of support on the Democratic side for strengthening those even further, and a lot of frustration with the fact that other states and certainly the national government has not done the same thing. And so, you know, I don't think there's anything shocking to me in terms of what's been the response from our California lawmakers. I mean, and the governor, obviously. I will say, personally, I was a little surprised that we heard House Majority Leader or Minority Leader, excuse me, Kevin McCarthy, still blame video games last weekend. I thought we had dispensed with that argument. But I think, you know, a lot of calls in general from Democrats to sort of strengthen what we already have here. And then a lot of really not a lot of response from Republicans in terms of what they want to do.
When you said the word routineness, that's kind of a sobering thought. It's almost as if these responses are ready to go because another one's right around the corner. Rafa, what has stood out to you so far from responses?
Well, I agree with Marisa. Nothing really different from the state, partly because this has been going on. The Democrats are challenging Trump all the time, and McCarthy and others are defending the president. What stood out to me is the presidential candidates on the Democratic side, especially Joe Biden and Cory Booker, who gave probably their most eloquent speeches in the entire campaign, because they didn't just focus on guns. They focused on the deeper question now, which is the rise of white nationalism. Now, in his inimitable style, Joe Biden then took his highest moment of the campaign when you could almost see him winning the nomination and the presidency and issued one of his goofball statements about poor kids and white kids that he then had to, as usual, explain and not explain very well. So it was a typical, that was typical. His speech was not typical. It was one of his most forceful and effective speeches, and Cory Booker as well.
Now, back in 1989, now Republican Governor George Dukmejian signed the nation's first assault weapons ban after a gunman killed several children in Stockton. In 94, Congress approved a national ban. Today, it's almost unimaginable that Republicans nationally would back a ban or a buyback like the one that Congressman Eric Swalwell has called for. What has changed in our political landscape, Rafe, would you say?
Well, I think what's changed is that the parties have coalesced around the pro and con position on this in ways that wasn't true in 1994. There's almost no Democrats at this point who, if it came to a vote, wouldn't vote for a ban, and there's almost very few Republicans who wouldn't. And the NRA simply became more firm in its position on blocking things after that and more effective until very recently, I'd have to say.
Marisa, on the NRA side of things, how would you describe their relationship with California's lawmakers?
Partisan, as we've seen nationally. I mean, of course, with a couple exceptions for sort of lawmakers that represent maybe more purple districts. But we did see some reporting this week really spelling out how the NRA has poured almost all its money when we talk about congressional races into Republicans, about $250,000 through their PAC to political candidates for the House since 2010. all but two of them are Republicans. And I think that speaks to the way that you see this really play out in terms of what Rafe's talking about, which is, you know, another example of the stratification of our system, our political system. You know, I think it is worth going back, and I've done some looks at this, and I know that the New York Times in particular has done some really good reporting on how the NRA got to this point itself, and the fact that they were not this sort of hyper-political, sort of guns-at-all-cost organization for a long time, and then in the last few decades, that's what they became. And I think that, you know, they certainly are still active at the state capitol. I don't think they have as much push as they used to. And I think one way we've seen that in California really play out is this way in which lawmakers, you know, Democratic lawmakers from swing districts or places that are more purple or just have, you know, a more rural sensibility, maybe people who grew up with guns, have, I think, increasingly become more willing to buck the NRA and maybe even some of their constituents who don't feel the need for these types of sort of sweeping non-gun control allowances. And I think that speaks to both the way politics has changed in California in terms of their parties, but also the fact that you do see a real difference between what people tell pollsters and what the NRA sort of says that their bottom line, bright line is when it comes to any of these laws.
And the funny thing is, so I know a lot of NRA members who are Democrats, who are in their 50s and 60s, and Marisa, as you said, who grew up in rural communities where guns were just a way of life for them, things that they shared with their families, and they're still members of the NRA, but they don't feel as good about it as they used to, Rafe. And it goes to what you said about how the NRA has kind of changed a little bit.
Well, it's changing again. The NRA is in the worst trouble it has ever been in modern times. They're facing an investigation about Russian money that passed through the NRA in the 2016 election. They are having leadership struggles, and it was just revealed that they had put aside $6 million for a mansion for Wayne LaPierre, the executive vice president, who's the leading light in the organization. They're being sued by board members, and even President Trump appears to be asking his aides whether the NRA is quite as tough as it always has been. So I do think the voters, generally favor legitimate gun control up to a point, but the NRA has been a tremendous obstacle. In suburban areas, guns are not as popular as they are in urban areas. And I'm here to tell you the Republican Party is desperately worried about losing the suburbs, and especially women voters in the suburbs. And if those voters rate the issue of guns high, you're going to see Republicans in Washington trying to take some action to not lose those voters.
Talking State of Affairs with Marisa Lago. She hosts the podcast Political Breakdown for KQED. Also, Rafe Sonnenschein. He directs the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Now, there's a George Skelton op-ed in the LA Times that examines gun control and why it's so hard to build a coalition behind it. He argues that it's not high on the priority lists of voters, while pro-gun voters are single-issue voters. Rafe, has anything you've seen in the past couple of weeks given you a reason to believe that voters are maybe reprioritizing gun control as an issue?
It depends which voters. And again, I would say suburban college-educated voters are probably changing on this. Mm. And I would say we've always underestimated the gap between both sides. Some of it has to do that there's nothing like the NRA on the other side. There's no organized force to give voice to people who want to change gun laws. I think that's changing. I also think that because of the issue of white nationalism and the charge that the president's rhetoric contributed to this, this may be the first set of shootings in which people say there may be an explanation, as opposed to a feeling like, what can you do about a lone person who's mentally disturbed? So this is a different debate than it's been.
Marisa, Congressman Eric Swalwell's call for an assault weapons buyback has found some support among presidential candidates. Biden, Sanders, O'Rourke have said they'd be open to a national buyback. Is there evidence that this could soon be another maybe litmus test for Democrats?
You know, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how the 2020 campaign is impacted by these shootings and whether this becomes a rallying cry. You know, I thought last week during the debates, it was surprising right after Gilroy that it took, I think in one night, they really never talked about gun control specifically, and the second night, maybe a little bit. Buyback specifically, perhaps. I mean, I think that there's pretty widespread agreement on the Democratic side of the aisle that there needs to be stronger laws. I think, you know, once you get into the nitty gritty of the policy, policies. Sometimes you can have disagreements, but certainly this is something that over the past 10, 15 years, as you know, we've talked about what's happened sort of on the right. I think on the left, there's been a coalescing effect. And I think that you would be hard pressed to find a mainstream candidate or one of the top tier candidates who's going to say they straight up oppose these types of things. You know, Beto, I think O'Rourke of Texas was sort of the one most on the fence about this, given his home state and sort of his background. But you have seen him really come out swinging in the past week. And I think that that's indicative of the fact that even in more rural communities, even in places where the sort of gun culture is stronger, that there's just a sense of really frustration and anger at all of this. And I think to Rafe's point, talk about parents. I mean, not just suburban moms, but just parents in general. I think there's a real fear you're hearing among Americans, and that crosses, you know, political, socioeconomic, racial lines entirely.
California State Assemblyman Chad Mays is calling for the state party to do more to denounce white nationalism. And you brought this up, Rafe, when it comes to what we're talking about here on State of Affairs. He's long been a black sheep among Republicans here. He's from Riverside, San Bernardino. What do you make of him? He's a moderate pariah, though, in his own party, and yet his own party in this state is losing ground each and every single day, it seems like.
Oh, I think the loneliest place in American politics is to be a Republican who's right about what the Republicans ought to do in the long term in order to have a genuine majority. And I think these are people who are in an impossible situation. And it doesn't mean that everybody favors white nationalism, et cetera, but it does mean the party would ultimately have to change. But in their mind, they're going down a path they like. He's been a pariah, and it puts him in kind of a nowhere spot. In many ways, maybe a prophet without honor in his own party.
Wow. Now, Marisa, keeping with last weekend's tragedies, they've become a major talking point in this presidential race. Most of it has not been in President Trump's favor. What have we heard from the campaigns there?
I think a lot of really sort of more pointed language around this question of white supremacy and racism. Candidates who, you know, I think had been very careful about how they frame this. I mentioned Beto O'Rourke, for example. I think have really sort of lost their temper in some ways, and in a way that's not inappropriate necessarily, but is just shows the fact that you can sort of come out and talk about how things were poll tested all day long, but when something hits your community, it feels very different. And so I think that we've seen them put a really fine point on the fact that a lot of these candidates do view the president as a racist, as inciting these white supremacists, and of really sort of stirring up the xenophobia that we're certainly seeing was a factor in both Gilroy and El Paso. And so I think, you know, you hate to say like, oh, the gloves come off now, because I think they've kind of been off for some time and it might get worse before it gets better, given the next year and a half we're all about to live through. But it certainly, I think in some ways, is a turning point in terms of the real language we're seeing, the pointed language and the ability to say, you know, for these candidates to say, we feel like this is something that sort of goes beyond whether we're worried about our electability to what I think they would argue is kind of a moral imperative.
Rafe, one last thing. If Congress fails to act on gun laws when it comes back from its recess, could it be the unexpected cudgel that maybe Democrats will use throughout the election? And how effective could it be at bringing people to the polls?
I think the bigger problem for Democrats is if they pass a very weak set of laws that appear to take some action, and Democrats have to decide whether to support it or not when they think it may not be enough. That is going to be a very likely possibility. My experience of these last few years is everything that we think is a make or break thing that week isn't a make or break thing a week after. But the white supremacy question is going to last throughout the entire campaign. And one thing I'd add is a lot of Democrats got awfully tired of Democrats yelling at each other about little nitpicky things that they did 10, 15 years ago. They finally sound like they're finding their voice around this issue.
Rafe Sonnenschein directs the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Marisa Lagos hosts the podcast Political Breakdown for KQED. Marisa, Rafe, thanks a lot.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
All right, as you know, we live in a hyper-partisan time. There ain't much anymore that's free from being politicized, from sneakers to fried chicken, everything in between. Now it's actually seeped into a place where people from both sides of the aisle go, a place that's supposed to be a sanctuary from politics, where, as Olivia Newton-John once sang, you go to get physical. Find out where that is when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, an online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an info session to learn more. Classes start September 3rd. Apply by August 5th for up to $8,000 in scholarships at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. All right, imagine you're at SoulCycle grinding away to Billie Eilish on a stationary bike for a nice workout. But then you hear that this weekend there's going to be a fundraiser for President Trump hosted by one of the billionaires who owns SoulCycle.
I'm the bad guy. Duh.
Well, that's what many left-leaning members of the gym are calling Stephen Ross. Ross is the chair of the company that owns SoulCycle, Equinox Gyms, the Miami Dolphins, and a lot of other stuff. Here in Los Angeles, celebrities like Chrissy Teigen ended their own gym memberships. But how could a boycott punish a guy who's already super rich? And is it actually fair to punish someone just because he's on the other side of the political spectrum? To walk us through the moralities of putting your money where your mouth is, we have LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. David, welcome back.
Thank you, Ray.
All right. In some ways, it feels like a very LA-specific problem where the affluent who can afford to go to Equinox or SoulCycle are torn between politics and physical fitness. So what are some of the things you've heard from people struggling with this?
Well, you hear from a lot of members who say they just don't want to stand to be associated with Donald Trump in any way, shape, or form. They didn't know that Equinox or SoulCycle were involved, and that's it. They're going to put their foot down. You know, there's a bunch of moving parts to this story. First of all, it's nothing new about voting with your wallet or voting with your purse. This has gone on, well, for a very, very long time. Think the civil rights for just one example. You know, the boycott of the buses. This really isn't any different from that. It's a way that for people who feel politically disempowered or disenfranchised to still make their voice heard economically. And since obviously money talks, it's not an unreasonable way to actually get up on your high horse and have a say. And I think the blowback we're seeing from the corporate world, from the capitalist world, is that, in fact, this is a very effective way of making your voice heard.
But Stephen Ross is going to be fine at the end of this. I mean, it's not going to really matter, is it, David? I mean, if someone decides to make an economic boycott out of this?
Well, you know, if you're Stephen Ross and you have a home in the Hamptons where you're able to put on multi-$1,000 fundraisers for Donald Trump, yeah, you'll probably be okay. But the simple fact is, many companies, not Equinox per se, but many companies have narrow margins, and it can be challenging if you start seeing your customer base leaving in droves. This is one reason why when something very controversial happens on television, for example, advertisers will pull their support for that show very, very quickly because they don't want their brand tarnished in any way. They don't want to see this reflected economically among their customers. And the same thing is happening here. Now, in the case of pulling out from Equinox or SoulCycle, the good thing is there are plenty of alternatives, especially in L.A. There are fitness clubs in this town. So if Equinox is not going to be your political cup of tea, you can go to L.A. Fitness. You can go to 24 Hour Fitness. You can go to many boutique places. On the other hand, we saw Armie Hammer, the actor, coming out today pointing out that the chairman of Marvel Entertainment, Isaac Perlmutter, also is a big Trump supporter. So does that mean we can't go to any more Avengers movies? It's not like there's a lot of good substitutes for that. The DC movies, not so much, you know?
But David, to be fair, not every member of Equinox or SoulCycle hates President Trump. And then you've got people that work there that maybe have no position on this. So local employees who really need their job. Is it fair to punish a company and maybe their employees because of the political beliefs of the top person?
Absolutely. Moreover, Equinox and SoulCycle both issued statements today saying, hey, Ross is a passive investor in our company, and what we do here in no way reflects his politics. Forgive and forget. Move on. Come on. Come in and have a workout. So they're trying to distance themselves from the boss, but here's the reality. He's the boss. He is the owner of the company, and if anyone is ultimately going to be hurt by customers leaving in droves, this is the guy. Now, he's not going to go bankrupt. He's not going to be selling off his yacht anytime soon. But at the same time, he's no dummy. He's a businessman. He wants his companies to make money. If customers aren't coming in and spending money, that's an issue for him.
Now, comedian Billy Eichner said on Twitter, quote, there are a handful of billionaires who own everything and many support Trump. Practically speaking, it's probably impossible to completely avoid them. And David, that got our staff thinking about the TV show The Good Place. And here's how they phrase this issue.
That's problem number one. Life is chaotic and messy and unpredictable. Problem number two, even if you do somehow manage to make good decisions, you still lose points because of the unintended consequences.
Yeah, there are booby traps everywhere. Like, there's this chicken sandwich that if you eat it, it means you hate gay people. And it's delicious.
It is.
David, what's the struggle then for consumers when they want to vote with their dollars, but also not have to worry about every single little purchase that they make?
You know, I would say that it's not about bringing a corporate behemoth to its knees. I'd say it's more about just simply the karmic satisfaction of knowing that you're doing something, that you individually are making your voice heard, even in a small, modest way. I think all boycotts are centered on that basic idea that we're all coming together to voice our own personal needs. And even if it doesn't cause any change whatsoever, even if Donald Trump gets reelected tomorrow, the mere fact for some people that they have actually been able to exercise their economic power, to flex their economic muscle, that's satisfying.
Now, what kind of effect, though, does peer pressure have when it comes to our buying practices? If our family and friends say that they plan to boycott or maybe buy more from a company based solely on its politics?
Well, that's very, very common, as a matter of fact. Look, consumerism is tribalism, and that's the bottom line to it. We are members of clubs, and I don't mean Equinox here. I mean the branded clubs, whether that's Abercrombie and Fitch or The Gap or Banana Republic. We perceive these as groups that we want to be associated with. Therefore, if there is a groundswell movement of people leaving that club, your first reaction as a club member is to say, do I want to be here? And that's the power of a boycott. That's the power of an economic move like this, is it starts gathering momentum. You don't want to be the last guy on the soul cycle thinking, oh, gosh, I'm alone in this room.
But really quick, where's that line, though? So say someone from now on continues to go to Equinox. Are they associated with being a Trump supporter? Because that's not necessarily the case.
No, and obviously it blows right by. And obviously people can make a perfectly reasonable argument of saying, no, I'm just here for a workout because I'm just here for a workout. Thank you very much. And I don't think anybody's going to look askance at you. Again, I think this is more about personal satisfaction as opposed to peer group pressure.
David Lazarus, consumer columnist for the LA Times. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, moving on to an issue that has yet again grabbed our attention this week, and that's gun violence. In this era of mass shootings, it's hard to process the details and devastation of each new tragedy. But many here in Los Angeles will never forget an anti-Semitic shooting at a Jewish community center in Granada Hills 20 years ago this weekend. That tragic event helped launch a national gun violence prevention movement. KPCC's Aaron Schrank spoke to survivors about what's changed since that day.
Josh Stepikoff was only 6 years old that morning at Jewish summer day camp when he was shot twice by a neo-Nazi with a semi-automatic rifle.
I remember when the gunman came in, and the next thing I remember, the pain and the horror. I ran as fast as I could, just in any direction I could until I got outside of the building.
Josh, along with two other little boys, a teenage girl counselor and an office worker, were injured in the gunfire. Before the shooter turned himself in, he killed Joseph Aleto, a Filipino-American mailman. The Granada Hills shooting became national news.
Once again, our nation has been shaken and our hearts torn by an act of gun violence.
Josh's summer camp was a flashpoint in a national conversation about guns and hate. And when he got out of the hospital, Josh's parents brought him back to camp on crutches.
I didn't want him to be afraid to be Jewish.
Alan Stepikoff is Josh's dad.
He just knew that somebody came in and started shooting. He didn't have the vocabulary for a religious or hate crime. He had no idea anything about that.
Josh's mom, Lauren Lieb, was at the JCC with her son when she first heard that moms across the country who had seen TV coverage of the shooting were trying to do something about it.
somebody said, oh, there's somebody's organizing a march in Washington for stronger gun laws. And that was the very first, you know, starting planning stages of the Million Mile March.
9 months later on Mother's Day, 750,000 people marched on the National Mall.
Gun control!
There were jumbotrons and celebrity speakers. Lauren was proud.
Many of us went into it thinking, wow, okay, we've kicked this problem to the curb. You know, this is solved. You can't have a demonstration with this many people, this much passion, this much emotion, and then just have nothing happen.
The Million Mom March later merged with the Brady Campaign, a leading political lobbying group against gun violence. Lauren's a 20-year veteran of the gun control movement. Alan joined the board of the local Anti-Defamation League. He started speaking against anti-Semitism and lobbying for hate crime laws in D.C. I meet Nina Lieberman outside the former JCC campus near a busy highway in Granada Hills. It's now home to a Jewish technical college.
I parked at the church, but then I just started walking. It's like a flood of memories.
20 years ago, she was a JCC executive who helped run the center. Lieberman points out that the armed guard shack, quickly built after the attack, is still standing.
It is the symbol of what happened with the shooting on August 10th, 1999. And that, you know, that makes me really sad.
She says the attack was a wake-up call for L.A.'s Jewish community. More synagogues across the city installed fences and hired armed guards. Lieberman says she'd rather remember what this place was like before the shooting.
It was just a place of so much fun and joy and a beautiful way to learn about Jewish life and Jewish traditions and a place where everybody felt safe.
Lieberman says enrollment at the North Valley JCC declined, especially after 9/11, and the center closed for good in 2002. Josh Stepikoff's family has spent 20 years sharing their worst day with the world, even as hate-filled mass attacks have grown more common and more deadly. Last weekend, two mass shootings in Ohio and Texas left at least 31 people dead.
It is very, very easy to be discouraged.
They haven't solved the problem, but they have learned gun violence prevention is about so much more than stopping mass shootings.
Like today, where two-thirds of those dying from gun violence is suicide.
As public as they've been as advocates, the Stepikoffs usually spend August 10th huddled together, out of the spotlight. But this year, 26-year-old Josh will be apart from his parents, honeymooning with his wife.
For the first time in 20 years, I will be away from them, and it is what it is, but I'll be in the Greek islands, so I can't complain too much.
Meanwhile, there are several local commemorations this weekend, including one on Sunday at Josh's synagogue. Covering religion and diaspora, I'm Aaron Schrank.
Now to military history. In 1958, Tom Bachi was involved in dozens of atomic tests in the Pacific. He serviced the planes that collected air samples before and after those tests. There are thousands like him, vets who never went to war but were exposed to radiation during this time. Many became sick years later. Now, instead of medals, the Pentagon is offering certificates to these vets. But as Stephanie Colombini reports for the American Homefront Project, the move leaves many of the so-called atomic veterans underwhelmed.
84-year-old Tom Bachi of Ormond Beach, Florida, is flipping through a scrapbook he keeps of old pictures and articles about his time in the Air Force.
This was our flight crew here, and that's me.
He never went to war, but he still feels like he was part of history. In 1958, Bachi was involved in dozens of atomic tests on the Eniwetok Atoll in the Pacific. He serviced planes that flew through mushroom clouds after explosions, while he and his comrades watched in awe from the island maybe 10 miles away.
You're a young kid, you know. You're out there and say, wow, look what they're doing. Look at this, you know. And they never told us, you know, the radiation, the after effects or anything.
Bachi points himself out in a photo of young men wearing khaki shorts, short-sleeve shirts, and baseball caps.
That was our protective clothing for the atomic bombs.
After decades of being sworn to secrecy, atomic veterans were finally able to share their experiences in the late 90s. Many realized they suffered from similar health problems, and the VA expanded benefits for some whose diseases the government deemed were linked to radiation exposure. Bachi's heart problems didn't qualify, but he pushed for years with the National Association of Atomic Veterans to at least get a service medal.
They felt that there needed to be some recognition of those of us that were there. that did this, you know, for the country, but forgotten.
But the military says giving out medals for non-combat hazardous service is inconsistent with its awards program. Still, the government is now acknowledging the atomic veterans. Congress required the Pentagon to issue certificates to eligible vets who request them. They haven't started going out yet, but some veterans and their families are disappointed they'll only receive a piece of paper.
That's an insult, really, to these men.
That's Judith Frederick. Her late husband, Walter, was involved in nuclear tests in Nevada in 1955. The Army veteran died in 2017 after battling radiation-related skin cancers and a nerve disease for decades.
A medal is something special, and the atomic veterans are a special class. They gave their lives for this country, and they are still giving their lives for this country, just like anybody that goes to Afghanistan, Vietnam, Korea, and gets shot.
It's not the first time non-wartime veterans have lost a similar fight. People who served during the Cold War era also pushed for medals but got certificates. Retired Colonel Fred Bork is a military historian who's written about awards. He says he understands why the atomic veterans want a medal, but says it's reasonable the Pentagon limits who gets them.
There's only so much money to go around, and if I'm trying to really take care of my people who are on active duty, and I want to motivate them today, that my policy and my focus has to be on the present and the future.
Still, Judith Frederick is holding out hope she'll get a medal for her husband one day, although she says he was so fed up with the military and the VA that by the time he died, he had no interest in an award.
Let's just say he thought it was too little too late. I feel a little differently about it.
Sitting at her Fort Lauderdale kitchen table, she clutches a letter he wrote to the government in the 80s as he fought for compensation. It's signed, "Yours truly, Guinea Pig." Frederick says she wants the medal to help her grandkids remember her husband's service and sacrifice. I'm Stephanie Colombini in Tampa.
You ever hear someone be described as salt of the earth? It's a compliment. It means they're a reliable, trustworthy person, someone you can really count on. Well, in that spirit, the city of Los Angeles is counting on salt in the earth to help them meet all of their big renewable energy goals. Coming up, find out why salt, the stuff you sprinkle right on your fries, can double as a clean energy battery. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. It almost feels as if salt has a million and one uses. From seasoning food to de-icing a highway and everything in between, salt really has nothing left to prove if someone claims it's the world's most useful mineral. However, now we may have to add clean energy storage to the list of things salt can do. Really, clean energy storage. In fact, the city of Los Angeles is counting on it and is looking at giant mounds of salt in Utah to do it. Sammy Roth covers energy for the LA Times. Sammy, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, so before we hear about why LA wants to get in the salt biz, tell us how salt can actually store energy.
Yeah, you know, it's really weird. So basically, in certain places, you've got these giant underground mounds of salt, you know, buried pretty deep beneath the earth. And the idea here is that when you've got, you can sort of carve these caverns out in the salt, these big sort of hollow caverns that you can carve with wells down there. And then when you've got extra solar or wind power, you know, it's the middle of the day, the sun is shining, you've got lots of solar, you know, similar with wind, you take that extra power, you use it to pack air really, really tight into these underground caverns, sort of like storing the sun or the wind in these, like, you know, bottles.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when you need it, you let the air back out, it expands, it turns a turbine, it generates electricity.
So this is happening, 100 miles south of Salt Lake City?
Just about.
Okay, so that sounds good so far. Those caverns, though, if this were to happen, are still 500 miles away, Sammy. So how would L.A. then get the electricity from Utah to California?
Well, it's this pretty nifty coincidence. L.A. has this coal plant that it operates at this site just outside of Delta, Utah. It's been there for 30 years. It's going to shut down in 2025. But in order to get the coal-fired electricity here, we built this 500-mile power line from Southern California to Utah. And once the coal shuts down, that line's going to be open. And lo and behold, the salt dome is right there next to the coal plant.
Okay, but here's the thing, though, too. To get the air out, L.A. would have to do something that a lot of environmentalists don't want them to do.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the getting the air expanded, what happens when you expand the air is that it gets very, very cold. It's just sort of basic physics, and that would freeze the equipment if you don't heat the air up. So what they would be doing is they would be burning natural gas in order to heat the air as it expands. So it's, you know, it's a way to store clean energy, but it's not entirely clean in itself.
And therein, as Hamlet said, therein lies the rub, right? Or therein lies the salt rub in our case, right? Because, yeah, the compressed air storage needs the natural gas. And Garrett Garcetti has said that the city's trying to move away from natural gas. So what are they going to do? I mean, they're kind of stuck in a weird spot.
It's a good question. So one thing to note is that compared to, like, a natural gas power plant, the salt dome stuff would use about half the gas as a gas power plant for the amount of electricity they're getting out of it. So it's, you know, gas is better than coal, and this is, you know, still better than a typical gas plant. The idea to solve that long term is they want to use hydrogen gas instead of the fossil fuel gas that contributes to climate change. The technology to do that is not economic right now. They're hoping that it develops by the time that we need to get fully off of fossil fuels, but it's a gamble.
So would they have to replace the city of L.A. would have to replace the coal plant with a different kind of plant, and then hopefully hydrogen would then be used down the road? Is that the proposed series of events?
Yeah. So there are two things happening here. One is this compressed air storage technology, which has this component of burning natural gas. The other thing that L.A. wants to do to replace the coal plant is to actually build a gas-fired power plant at this same site in Utah. And for that one as well, they are kind of banking on being able to switch to hydrogen eventually, but it's an unknown.
Yeah, we're talking to Sammy Roth of the L.A. Times about L.A. possibly using massive Utah salt caverns for energy storage. Now, let's just say the L.A. DWP builds the natural gas power plant for the compressed air storage that ultimately would power us here in L.A. Would the clock, though, be ticking on how long they could use that plant according to California law?
Yeah, so California passed a bill called SB 100 last year, which says that 100% of our electricity must be from zero carbon sources by 2045. So that's, you know, renewables like solar and wind and geothermal, it's hydropower, it, you know, potentially nuclear if we were to still have any of that. But, you know, basically that puts this natural gas stuff in a position where either they got to figure out a way to use a fuel that isn't gas, or they're going to have to shut it off in all likelihood.
And this plant would be expensive, right? So if we go down this road and nothing happens with hydrogen, no advances in technology where it makes it safe or doable, then we'd be stuck with a big bill.
Yeah, it would be a big bill. I mean, they're planning to invest. The gas plant is like an $865 million project,
Yikes.
Most of which probably gets paid for by Los Angeles. Harder to pin a cost right now on the salt dome storage stuff. But yeah, it's a gamble.
You know, Sammy, my grandson lives near Salt Lake City, so I've been making the commute up the 15 to go visit him a few times in the last year. All I see there is open space. So why can't L.A. maybe look to building solar or wind farms that could benefit that part of Utah's economy and then also meet our energy goals?
So that's a really good question. They are definitely planning to do some of that. I mean, the idea with this underground salt storage stuff is that you build solar in the area, you build wind in the area, or maybe in Wyoming nearby, which has really strong wind. And then you use that to, you know, power the, you know, charge these underground batteries that you've got. It's a question of whether that can do everything, whether that can be the, you know, totally reliable energy source for us. Right now, City of L.A. has argued no, they need this gas plant as well. But that's kind of an open question.
And Philip Anschutz, the guy who owns Staples Center and the Kings, he's looking to Wyoming, as you mentioned, right, for that wind energy that maybe can then use Utah's transmission line to bring it down here?
Yeah, that's one of the really interesting components of this. The wind in Wyoming is so, so good that you've got Phil Anschutz is one of the richest guys in the country. He's trying to build the largest wind farm in the country out there. And one of the ideas that they've been sort of discussing with L.A. is rather than build their own power line all the way to the city, build their power line just out to this site in Utah and then use the existing line to go the rest of the way, which would be interesting.
So the salt caverns then, going back to the salt caverns, dude, how realistic is that right now for LA? I know we're talking about it and it is a possibility, but I mean, if we want to meet our goals and then still be able to get the energy in a way that satisfies most environmentalists, I mean, are we looking at a compromise or just reality just doesn't add up that way?
Well, that's such a good question. I mean, there's, you know, California has set this 100% clean energy goal, And the reality, I think, is that we know how to get a lot of the way there, but it's not entirely clear yet how we're going to sort of get that last stretch from maybe, you know, 70 or 80 or 90% clean to 100. And this is definitely a technology that could help. It's a technology that's it's been actually used for a long time, but only at a small handful of places. So it's kind of, you know, a proven technology. It just hasn't been used in this kind of application before, probably for the kind of scale that LA wants. So I'm not a betting person, but I am. You know, it's hard to forecast.
I think a lot of people, especially us here in Los Angeles, we want that ideal, perfect solution, right? But it just doesn't seem like it can happen, or at least is realistic.
Well, this is something that comes up in a lot of stories that I do about, you know, clean energy, renewable energy sources. You know, you've got big solar and wind farms, and people oppose those because they don't like them near their homes or because they destroy habitat. You've got lithium-ion batteries to store solar and wind power that is based on mining of metals in countries where, you know, child labor is exploited to do it in a lot of cases. Like, you know, climate change is a huge, huge problem. We definitely need solutions. There are definitely arguments over, you know, solutions that are good but not perfect, and that comes up everywhere.
Sammy Roth covers energy for the LA Times. Sammy, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, now to an update on a story we discussed yesterday about the Metro Gold Line. Last night, the San Gabriel Valley Council of Governments unanimously approved an extension for the train that would bring it to the city of Pomona. The vote allows $126 million to be used to connect the San Gabriel Valley to the Inland Valley without any further delays. The landslide 27-0 vote followed a tense debate over the use of transportation funds for future projects, but Gold Line supporters won out. The option to extend the Gold Line even further into the cities of Claremont and Montclair, however, is still pending, but the Gold Line Construction Authority stated it's hopeful for additional expansion. The Pomona Gold Line rail extension is expected to be finished in 2025. All right, it's going to be warm this weekend, but not uncomfortably hot. No clouds in the forecast. So if you want, you can also soak in that sunshine, too. What to do, what to do, what to do with the weekend? Well, lucky for you, you really don't have to think about it too much because we have a list of the coolest stuff, and you're going to hear that next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Now, it's been a long week, so now that it's Friday, let's talk about something fun. There's a lot to do this weekend in Southern California, so if you already don't have plans, we've got your guide right here.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran, and A. Martinez, there's been a lot of animal cafes, right?
Yes.
One's for cats, some for dogs. All right, so there's a special one today that you can only go to until 6 p.m. So fans of that great Amazon show Fleabag, which we just heard about 30 seconds ago. So the main character has a guinea pig, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so from now until 6 p.m. is a Fleabag guinea pig cafe. This is a pop-up in West Hollywood. It is first come, first serve, so if you really want to go, go now to try and get in line. Then, of course, you'll be able to hang out and cuddle with some guinea pigs while enjoying some complimentary snacks and drinks. You are really cringing at this
idea. Different people have different interests. I can't judge. All right. There are also some non-furry animals to see this weekend.
Yeah. So over in Pomona at the Fairplex, tomorrow and Sunday is the Reptile Super Show. Are you good with that? Do you like
that? I guess I'm not, maybe. I should just be honest.
Oh, okay. Well, for people who do want to go, they can see geckos, snakes, cool. chameleons, and more this weekend at this Reptile Spectacular. Really, audience, you cannot see how much he's cringing at this. But there are going to be educational workshops for owners and prospective owners. Check out the latest gear and supplies, too. And entry starts at $9.
All right, enough with the animals. What if I just want to have a blast and party?
All right. So, fine. I've got the event for you over in Venice. Starting today through two Sundays from now is this event by the shoe company Vans. It's called Black Rainbows, and it's to celebrate the history of skateboarding in SoCal. Ooh. So there's going to be 10 days of an immersive skateboarding experience. So, for example, there will be punk shows, skate trivia nights, screenings, and more. Plus, every day starts with a waffle brunch.
Nice.
I don't know how that factors into skating, but waffle brunch, hey?
Who cares?
Best part, this is free, but with an RSVP.
All right. Finally, what about something for people who just want to relax? Old people like me.
Then go have a picnic. This Sunday at Glendale's Brand Library is a community picnic. This event is called Food and Art in the Park. So don't worry about bringing your own, actually. There will be food trucks to sample from. Then for the art, there will be artists and curators to give you tours of the latest exhibition at the library. And this event, it's free. Now, there's actually a lot more going on here this weekend. You can check out our full list of events on laist.com. That is laist.com. And if you ever wanted to Twitter me at all. It's at Leo Has a Cat, at Leo Has a Cat.
That's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
See you later, eh?
All right, keep it tuned all day here at KPCC because coming up at 3:30, we have The Frame with John Horn. John's with us now. What do you got coming up on the show?
We are going to talk to a comedian. His name is Julio Torres. He is from El Salvador. You could say he's a stand-up comedian, but he does most of his acts sitting down because he has this crazy conveyor belt that brings along these tiny objects and he tells stories about them. Sounds strange, is strange, but is also, I think, really funny.
I've seen it. It is hilarious. Now, okay, one thing that you got going on is that The Frame is now on the weekends.
Yeah, if you don't get enough of us during the week, you can hear more over the weekends. It's Saturdays at 2, and basically it is the best of the week's show. And then sometimes we add some new interviews. So even if you listen to every episode of The Frame during the week, you should tune in because there's more.
Now, John, far be it from me to tell you what to do, but you had Gina Davis on this week. Will we be hearing her on the Saturday show?
We will be hearing from Gina Davis. She is in and is the executive producer of a new documentary about how things are improving, or I guess not improving, for women in Hollywood. You know, Gina Davis was in Thelma & Louise, A League of Their Own. So Gina Davis is going to talk about Hollywood, how it treats women and people who aren't white men. It's sobering, but I think it's a story that needs to be told.
All right. Anything else on the Saturday show?
Ben Stiller comes on the show. Yeah. Now, you probably know him as an actor and as a guy who does funny movies like Zoolander. He directed a really good Showtime series that's up for a bunch of Emmys called Escape from Donnemara. It's the true story of a couple of guys who broke out from a maximum security prison with the help of a woman who worked in the tailor shop. And I got to say, Ben Stiller really directed it well. It's great filmmaking and a pretty good interview, I think.
All right, The Frame today at 3:30 and then tomorrow on Saturday at 2. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Wei.
That's it for Take Two this week. The show was edited by Sue Carpenter. Our producers are Lori Skywalker Galaretta and Leo Duran. Austin Cross directed the show. Megan Shalong helped out with some production. Tamika Adams is our news apprentice. The program is engineered, as always, by Hazmik Pogosian. Our senior producer is Megan Larson. If you missed any part of the program today, you're lost. But you can make up for it. Just find us wherever you get your podcast. Just find Take Two, and we'll be there to entertain and inform you. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. You can find me there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. I'm talking over Prince. How dare I? Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back Monday at 2:00.